The year that today's album was released, nothing happened. No, not really. But the year before that, people were really concerned that their computers would, I don't know, run out of numbers or something. I never understood it. At the time, I was young enough to think flying cars were around the corner anyway. Needless to say, I was disappointed. In lieu of a single artist, I'm going to focus on a producer for the middle bit of trivia this week. This week's producer has worked with a rock band whose name translates to The Wolves, the lead singer of Led Zeppelin, and finally put together the music for a Civil War film that I remember being supremely depressing. This week's album started its decade out with a bang, earning itself a place on NPR's list of the decade's most important recordings. The year, of course, is Y2K itself. That's the year 2000 for our younger listeners. The producer was T-Bone Burnett, and by extension, I suppose, Joel and Ethan Cohen, who are themselves Two Dudes and Tunes alumni after a fashion. The album is the soundtrack to one of Wood and I's favorite films, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Today on Two Dudes and Tunes. You are listening to Two Dudes and Tunes, the podcast that is a geographical oddity, 2 weeks from everywhere. My name is Chris Robinson, and the feller who is shackled to me via this podcast is himself a Dapper Dan man, if I had to guess. Wood, how are you?
Dude, I am doing great. I don't want no fop.
I'm a Dapper Dan man. That's one of George Clooney's best roles.
Oh, yeah. No, so I rewatched that movie in preparation for this podcast, and everybody in that movie, it's one of their best roles. I mean,
oh,
it's
absolutely. So good.
Hands down, still
it fires on all cylinders. It's kind of funny, actually, when we were talking about doing this podcast and doing the prep work for it, this episode, like the podcast in general, in like December or whenever that was, we were talking about that. I watched this movie because we had talked about this album on the like in one of our like planning sessions, and I just sat down and watched it. I wish I had had time to rewatch it this week because it's so good.
Well, as of this recording, it's not available for free on any of the streaming services I subscribe to, so I ended renting it on Amazon Prime for $4, and it was worth every penny.
Oh, this is one that I've been meaning to buy and just haven't yet. I need to go down to Ralph's Records here in Lubbock, Texas, give a little shout out to like a cool small business here in town. They have a bunch of really neat, obscure DVDs. They have like old video game consoles. They have a ton of records, like more than you could shake a stick at. It's a really cool place here in town.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So how's your week been, man?
It's been good. I've been enjoying that second week off of paternity leave with Tiffany and Mav. Our quarterly wine subscription came due, so we made our trek up to Fredericksburg, Texas, and picked up our wine subscription and walked the main street there and did a couple of touristy things and ate at a German restaurant called Auslander, which I believe you mentioned by name on this podcast few months ago.
Sure so did.
We did that, and it was hot as all get out outside. I felt like I spent the rest of the week cooling off. Let's see what other interesting things happened this week. I've mentioned on the podcast that I've been working my way through the degrees of Freemasonry. And so last night I passed a huge test and completed the first degree. And so I'm excited to be moving on to the second degree.
Congrats.
Yeah, it was a lot more work than I thought it was going to be. Like, it has been almost all consuming, as much as my master's degree was.
So. Well, your master's degree didn't give you access to the levers of power in the United States and the world as we know it. So
I'm just going to say
a lot more at stake.
My sister, who's off to West Point, was making jokes about it being like the National Treasure gatekeepers.
Yeah. You know,
us and Nick Cage. And I pointed out to her, we meet in a 120-year-old building that we can't afford to replace the roof on, and everybody's car parked out front is like some beat up old jalopy that makes that Hyundai you used to drive look like a nice car.
Yes. And oh, man.
She was like, that's a good cover. They go home and get in their Bentleys. I was like, probably.
I love it. Also, thank you for shouting out an old, old car of mine. I was talking to somebody the other day about how cars were so hard to work on right now. And I brought up the time that you helped me take the exhaust manifold
off. That was off. The intake manifold off.
Intake manifold. See, you're the one who knows.
Just to change the back set of three spark plugs on.
Yes.
What kind of trash is that? So frustrating.
And that was on a 2000, ladies and gentlemen, 2000 Hyundai Sonata.
Yeah, you could change the front three. You couldn't change the back three.
So goofy. But anyway.
The best thing about that car was your dad wired a horn by adding a button to the dash when the horn died, and it set off some janky horn in the.
Oh, no, that wasn't my dad. That was me.
Oh, even better.
Yes, that was definitely me.
That was the most bubba'd thing I have ever seen.
Oh, man. And on a 2000 Sonata, too, which is like just insult to injury almost.
So what else is new with you?
Well, really the only thing that's kind of that exciting this week is Megan and I finally got to go to the movie theaters. We went and saw the new adaptation of the Lin-Manuel Miranda musical In the Heights. And we both really enjoyed it. I would say the music is good, but probably not quite as good as Alexander Hamilton. But I really enjoyed it. There was a lot of spectacle. They made sure to at least do things in the film that they couldn't do on Broadway. So it was a lot of fun, like a really good popcorn flick, I think.
Yeah. And I watched it from the comfort of my couch on HBO Max because, and this isn't a plug for HBO Max or anything, but one of the things I've really liked about them is they release their movies on HBO Max and in the theaters on the same day. So yeah. For a limited run, like for the first 2 weeks of a movie, you can see it on HBO Max, and then it goes to theaters only for the next several months. But so I watched it at home, and I really enjoyed it, too. I told you through text that I wasn't as big of a fan of it, but that's because I'm comparing it to Hamilton. For those who aren't familiar, In the Heights was the first Broadway musical that Lin-Manuel Miranda did, and it came out in 05 or 06. And so there's a good 10 years of Lin-Manuel Miranda developing his style and working on his craft between these two musicals. And I feel like it really shows. This is a lot rawer and less refined as Hamilton is, but it is funny to see kind of that common through line, like those big punchy numbers. Like, you know, it's definitely Lin-Manuel Miranda who wrote this. Like, there's no guessing.
Absolutely. It's got his personality all over it. It's fantastic.
I loved their casting for Usnavi. If it wasn't going to be Lin-Manuel Miranda using that actor, and I'm sorry I'm blanking on his name at the moment. It's been my crutch lately. Phenomenal pick. And then picking... oh, man, dude, I am.
I'm going to look up the Jimmy In the Heights Smits. IMDb.
Picking Jimmy Smits to play.
And Anthony Ramos is Anthony the other Ramos. Actor you were and trying to think Hamilton. Of. Usnavi.
So he's just phenomenal. And then Jimmy Smits, who is probably one of my favorite TV character actors.
Yeah, he's great, man.
He's so good. And he can sing. Like, I was really blown away how good he was singing. Because he doesn't really have a musical voice when he's talking. So the whole thing was great. I loved being able to, I had heard the music before, listened to the musical. I have a rule about that we'll talk here in a little bit about, but listening to the music before I watch it. And so I loved the music, just listening to it on Spotify and being able to put visuals to it and seeing the story of Abuela coming together. Like, all of that was just really phenomenal. But all that said, it's a distant second to what Hamilton, the stage production, is. And it makes me want to see what they would do for Hamilton as a movie.
See, I did not know. So you said that In the Heights came first.
Way
that was
before.
His first. That's interesting. There is a real big jump in like quality of melody and stuff between. I mean, we don't want to turn this into Hamilton because we're going to talk about Hamilton at some point, I hope.
He wrote In the Heights, I believe, in 2002, 2003, and it hit Broadway in 2005.
That's interesting. Also, by the way, apologies, folks, if y'all hear me slurping on a summertime drink. I have a rum and Coke with a little bit of lime thrown in.
So great.
But anyway, to get back to that. Yeah, that's interesting that he wrote it. That kind of gives the music a little bit more context for me. I'm sure we need to wrap up small talk, but like it did sound.
Welcome to In the Heights talk, where Wood and Chris really just tear into it.
No, and I really did enjoy it, but that does give a little bit of context for some of the like rap and how it sounds like. It sounds a little dated, and I don't think I realized that was kind of the feeling I had about it. Not that I didn't enjoy it. The music was fun, but it definitely feels like pop from, you know, 02, 03, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Mixed in, of course, with all the, like, the, you know, Latin music styles and flavors and stuff.
From a cinematic perspective, I loved the color palette of this movie. It is so vibrant and alive. Which is funny to me because I've been to New York City a couple of times. I've never been to Washington Heights, but I've been to New York City a few times, and it is not colorful like that. So it's like,
you've been to the drab white person portion of New York City.
I've been to Tribeca. Come on.
Love it. Well, tell you what, let's leave the Heights behind and get into Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Does that sound good?
Taking a time machine, man. Let's do it.
All right.
Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou? December 5th, 2000. You know what I'm upset about, Chris, is the fact you didn't mention The Matrix when you were doing the intro.
I should have. That was 1999.
That was the end.
I mean, I mentioned 1999, technically, in the intro, but... Yeah, I don't want to get too sidetracked into other movies that I love because
other
we will
movies
be here
with great
for 4 hours. Yeah, yes, absolutely. December 5th, 2000. I wish I could remember what year I actually saw this because I remember my dad and my uncle and my pop renting this movie and watching it. And I don't remember if it was in the year 2000 or not. Mm-hmm. But that was how I got into the soundtrack is the three of them loved this movie. And I was trying to think about it. I started playing guitar in 2003 and I remember trying to pick up some of the like more accessible tracks on this album. I think the kind of solo acoustic version of Man of Constant Sorrow. I remember vividly sitting down and trying to pick that and playing it in my grandparents' house in Abilene. So that was kind of my route into this album. What was yours? When did you first become aware of this album? Because this is one that you like. This was not new to you at all.
Oh, yeah. Look, when this was on your list and we were doing the original list last December, I just about fell out of my chair. I was so excited that this was on it.
It's so good.
This is a top 10 guilty pleasure movie for me. And the reason it is the music, honestly. I mean, there's a lot of great lines in this movie, but this is a movie that is driven by, the plot is driven by the music, which in my mind makes this a musical. And we can fight about that a little
interesting.
Bit.
Interesting. I don't know if I would fight you on that, but pitch it to me after you get done telling me about your introduction to it.
So I know for a fact I saw this movie in theaters in the year 2000 when I was 12 years old at least a dozen times.
Oh, man, I love it.
And I'm going to tell you a little story. I had two brothers at the time. They were all about the same age, so no big span between us. And we had a habit of buying matinee tickets to movies and then theater hopping until we got kicked out.
Oh, that's the best. Oh, I wish I had not been such a square. I would have gotten so much mileage out of that if I had known that was a thing I could get away with.
Well, my mother hated this movie. Based solely on the trailer for this movie, which if you go back and watch it, the trailer for this is such a 1980s style trailer. It's not even funny. Like, it is the weirdest produced trailer ever. And it has some questionable comments in it. And my mom was just like, absolutely not. And so we would buy, we would buy tickets to go see something else. And we would go see that something else, whatever it was. And then we'd sneak into the next showing of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Or The Matrix. Or, you know, I remember doing an Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And The Matrix doubleheader is one of the ones, man, we did.
That is a trip, by the way. That is a weird pairing of movies, but I love it.
Whatever was in the theaters, we were going to be there. And so that was kind of the thing. Kids, don't do that. That's technically stealing. So be a better person than I am.
This is true. This is true. Don't steal.
Theaters got a lot smarter. Like, our new favorite theater chain to go through is Alamo Drafthouse. And they check your ticket at your seat every showing. So
really? Interesting. They don't do that out here in Podunk Lubbock.
Well, I think it's because Alamo Drafthouse, all the seats are like recliners and every seat has a table. And so you order like beers at your table or food.
Yeah,
or all
that's
that.
True.
So your ticket has to be hanging right
do.
There.
Yeah, so, yeah, they have to. They have to be doing that. I didn't think about that. Yeah.
So
that's
so you don't
why
get,
didn't I know that?
You don't get away with it anymore. So much. But back when AMC 24 was a thing in San Antonio.
Yes.
There was a lot of free movies. I owe them some money, probably.
You could have gotten away with it at Northwoods, but not anywhere else.
That's
awesome.
I think what the draw to this movie was, is it's another one of those movies that both of my brothers and I really liked. Like, it was something we could go watch, and we were super competitive with each other to the point of there were times when we did not talk to each other without, like, it turning into just a knockdown, drag out fight over stupid things.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so being able to go do a movie and all of us kind of pick the same thing was kind of cool. I love the fact that the music for this movie is so good, that it's so emblematical of the time that the movie is set in, but it's also accessible to kids of the 2000s who, I didn't know what bluegrass music really was. I wasn't in that genre of, you know, that super subculture 1930s style folk music was not something I was interested in when I was 12 years old. I was too busy listening to AC/DC and trying to be cool like my dad.
Yeah.
And so this movie just really jumped out and grabbed me and grabbed my imagination. And the actors, I mean, everybody in this movie is phenomenal. So made it fun to watch and fun to quote. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I see. That's why I feel like I saw the movie. I must have seen the movie like as soon as my dad and uncle and pop watched it, because I remember watching this movie for the first time in my grandparents' house. And I wasn't that old. Mm-hmm. Like, I was however old I was when the movie came out. They didn't like shield it from me. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the music, I mean, it's such a powerful, without the music, I don't think this film would have half the emotional clout that it does.
This movie without music is probably not a good movie. Like, it's quotable, it's fun, but you're not going to return to it. It's the music that brings you back to it. And it's the selective smorgasbord, if you will, of just artists and context. And this goes back to something we mentioned earlier. I have a very strict rule about musicals. Before I will watch a musical, before I will even going to see something live at the theater, I will sit down and I will listen to the music and just close my eyes and imagine what I think it should be. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, if the music stands on its own, if it's good by itself, just what I can picture in my mind's eye, I know I'm probably going to like whatever that musical is as a stage production or a movie or whatever. Mm-hmm. And this movie, I don't remember having that rule when I was 12 years old. I probably didn't. I mean, I'm sure I snuck in to see it the first time because my mom said no, and we were like, ha, watch this.
Yeah. And take that, mom.
Funny story about that. A couple of years after this happened, the church that we went to had like a Wednesday night movie night, and they showed this movie for like Wednesday night movie night. And my mom went and saw it and like really ended up liking it. But my brothers were sitting in the back quoting it line for line. Like we knew every line perfectly.
Giving yourself away.
Totally narked on ourselves.
Oh man, that's amazing.
And I have my youngest brother can do, even at like 10 years old, when he was 10 years old, he could do the perfect George Clooney. Like he's so good.
I love it. That's so great.
But anyhow. That to wrap that up, though, if a musical is good, if the music of a musical is good, then the rest of the musical is going to be good to me. And this started a little bit of a conversation between you and I yesterday in text. Because my notes for this episode says La La Land is a trash movie because the music doesn't stand on its own. And you and Megan have a very different opinion. I don't think Ryan Gosling can sing. And I don't I don't think that it's a good movie, and I don't think the music is good. Far as to call it trash. And you took some you took some offense to that.
I took umbrage because we don't need to adjudicate the is La La Land good. Wait,
were you wearing a pink dress?
No.
I shall not tell lies. Umbridge.
Oh, yes. No, I don't love it enough to like force you to write words on a scroll with a pen that carves them into your hand. But yeah. So you're talking about we've mentioned how crucial this is, and the way the film was developed, the Coens actually decided to develop the soundtrack before filming. Like they picked out songs that they didn't pick them out. That so T-Bone Burnett, good grief, I had one drink and I'm already going off the rails here. T-Bone Burnett and Alan Larman were invited to design collections of music. That's from Wikipedia. And so they compiled this really interesting variety of music from that period, just to, in case anybody for whatever reason doesn't know what O Brother Where Art Thou is about. It's a film set in the state of Mississippi during the Great Depression. And it's the tale of Ulysses Everett McGill, played by George Clooney, Pete, played by John Turturro, and Delmer O'Donnell, played by Tim Blake Nelson, in search of treasure that Ulysses claims he knows the location of. And so it's this ridiculous caper film where the three of them are just trying to make it through, this Depression era South to get this treasure.
For those who are literary people, it's a thinly veiled analog to Homer's Odyssey. Like,
I think the Coens
policy, plot.
The Coens, I think, said that they like read a plot synopsis.
Yeah, they didn't read
and that
the
was it. Like this was not their like adaptation. But this film is super atmospheric. It's very like mystical Americana, and I think the music is what gives this film like its power because there's such a nice wide range of emotional tones. There's some real like mysterious kind of mystical vibes and Hard Time Killing Floor blues. There are religious tunes like Down to the River to Pray. And there's some like fun, irreverent kind of comic stuff like In the Jailhouse Now. And what's the track at the beginning of it? Big Rock Candy Mountain. You know, there's just such a variety of emotional moods, and I think that is what one of the things that really makes the film and the album strong is it doesn't get stuck on just one note, you know, because you can easily imagine this kind of going one way or the other, where they decide, okay, this is all going to be like vocal dirges and like old like war callers, or this is going to be nothing but just straight banjo and guitar bluegrass. But they really mix up everything and create this amazing, like, I don't know what you would even call like a stew or like a potpourri of just so many flavors that have a lot of like, give the film a lot of verisimilitude. And I mean, obviously we're talking about it here. This is one of the few soundtracks that are on our lists, because I think it stands on its own much more than other music that might be as good, right? Like John Williams is amazing. And some people do enjoy sitting and listening to film scores outside of the film, but there's a lot of film music that just doesn't work by itself. You need the context emotionally of the scene where the two lovers break up or where the main character dies or whatever. But I feel like this soundtrack stands on its own in a way that few soundtracks often do.
Yeah, and you want to talk about a soundtrack that really launched a bunch of people's careers. This was, you know, Down to the River to Pray, you mentioned earlier. This was Alison Krauss's first breakout hit. I mean, this song was in every church, and it was featured in every, you know, every religious movie for like 10 years, it seemed like. And it really gave her a platform. But when you look through some of the other artists that performed on this this album, Ralph Stanley, who performed "O Death," that man won a Grammy for "O Death," and that song cuts through. And he had been singing for you know 50 years and was a relatively unknown singer up until that point. And the last 20 years ended up being just great for him after this. So it's kind of interesting to see how you could have so many different groups record so many different kinds of music, compile it into something by the Coen brothers, and have them structure a story around it in a way that made the music kind of the center point.
Yeah.
We probably don't want to spend too much time talking about the Ku Klux Klan scenes, but even the music for those scenes is incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
The way that they're marching and choreographed together with it is just interesting.
Yeah, all the interplay between action in the film and music is just so striking. Like the song "In the Highways" is always striking to me, because I always remember him running into his daughters in town, Ulysses Everett McGill, right? And his daughters saying,
"Daddy? He ain't our daddy."
"Hell, I ain't. What's this Warby gals? Your name's McGill."
"No, sir, not since you got hit by that train."
"What are you talking about? I wasn't hit by any train."
"Mama says she was hit by a train. Bluey. Nothing left. Just a grease spot on the L&N."
"Damn it. I wasn't hit by any train."
It's just so, the music is so pitch perfect with the movie. I don't know. It's just incredible. You were talking about artists who kind of got a boost financially or otherwise from this movie. James Carter is the guy who sings "Poe Lazarus," the kind of chain gang work song that opens the film. And the folk preservationist Alan Lomax, this guy who went around, I'm going to get the decades wrong, but I want to say in like the 20s and 30s, maybe even a little bit before then, went around and like it made it his mission to collect folk songs from different American traditions. And the recording on this album is from one of Alan Lomax's recordings of James Carter singing that song. And this is taken from the Pitchfork review of this. They did kind of a retrospective on it. Burnett worked with an investigative reporter and Lomax-affiliated licensing personnel to track Carter down and give him the check he'd earned. Carter got a $20,000 lump sum and a trip to the Grammys with his family, who continued to receive the royalties that arrived after his death in late 2003. You know, that's like a very real world benefit that the producers of this album, and I'm sure the Coens, didn't want to use anybody's music without their permission. Mm-hmm. You know, that was just something neat that they care enough about the history of American folk music and its place in this movie and in musical history to track somebody down and really give them their due.
Well, and one thing I really appreciate about this film as a whole and the album that goes with it is the fact that the music really sets the mood and the timbre of the rest of the film. Like, there are a lot of scenes that you can see taking place in modern day if it weren't for the score sounding like it was recorded in the 30s. And and seeing, you know, it's not just about the 30s cars and the, you know, the five and dime or whatever that they're in, but it's hearing the music that just sets the scene for everything else that's going on screen and really ties it all together in a very nice package as a whole.
You could say it really ties the room together.
Yes.
To quote another Coen. And the tradition is, I think the traditional religious music in this movie is something that maybe kind of sold my mom on letting me watch it. And it's something, honestly, that kind of got me into singing. I remember having this album and going on like a really long road trip somewhere. I think Dad was probably deployed. He was in the Army, but just for the sake of the listeners, you know this, obviously. And so we were driving probably from like La Mesa or Lubbock back to, I don't know, maybe we even lived in Ohio at the time, or we were driving back to San Antonio. I don't remember what part of my life it was, but this was an album that I kind of learned to sing harmonies to. I'd always kind of grown up in Church of Christ churches where hymnal singing is a big thing. And having this to kind of sing along to at home, not thinking about it, helped me out as a musician because I had just that real simple kind of unadorned style of music to listen to. Mm-hmm. You know, with folk music, there's a lot going on, but there are not a lot of competing voices and textures. Everything's kind of working much more in concert than maybe some contemporary music is. And the vocals are the point. You know, you won't hear anybody. I mean, you might hear somebody like with a tin ear that just can't carry a tune in a bucket or whatever. But it's going to be rare. Most folk music like this is delivered by people who've been playing and singing since they were like old enough to stand. And, you know, be just the traditional element of it. People pass this down in a very serious way. And that, I don't know, that's something that for me personally was just so powerful about this music, is it had ties to stuff I sang in church every day, and also just kind of got me into expressing myself in that way and having that ability to sing harmonies as like kind of a skill set. Oh, another thing that just kind of ties in, this is probably a little bit scattershot of an episode because we don't have one single artist to talk about, but I do want to mention Dan Tominski by name. For one thing, he won a Grammy for this album for a vocal performance. Let's see, Best Country Collaboration with Vocals, Dan Tominski and Pat Enright, who's another figure in the Nashville country scene. But this is another thing that really had a huge influence on me as a musician. The Eric Clapton Crossroads DVD of 2004 makes its second appearance in our podcast. You might remember that I mentioned it talking about John Mayer, but Dan Tominski and another guitarist and musician that he worked with, Ron Block, perform the an acoustic. It's like the first occurrence of the song in the film, where it's just acoustic guitar and vocals singing "Man of Constant Sorrow." And it's the kind of thing that got me to pay a little bit more attention to acoustic music, because being a young kid playing electric guitar, I had no interest in, you know, the quiet, soft-spoken Simon and Garfunkel aspect of music. I wanted to rock, you know. So, and that performance on that DVD is super exciting because they both trade solos, and that song has that just shuffling energy, and the vocal harmonies in it are just so excellent and raw and just like, we keep saying it, but pitch perfect. This album didn't just affect me either. It not only boosted the careers of people, but like the band Old Crow Medicine Show, which I think, if I'm not mistaken, we can throw a buzzer in if I'm wrong, but I think they did some work on this album. I think there were some of the instrumentals on it. And this was a real boon for them, but also like the Abbott Brothers, the Carolina Chocolate Drops, and Mumford and Sons basically had an easy in because of this film. Mm-hmm. Like, this primed the pump for non-country, non-folk music listeners to go like, oh yeah, that's a thing that I recognize.
Yeah, that's not trash.
And so then all of a sudden, like, there are 1,000 folk hipster, you know, like wannabe folk artists, which, you know, you could debate whether that's a good thing or not, but it really created a space that is, I think, well deserved for that kind of music. You know, I don't know if we would have Iron and Wine if we didn't have A Brother Where Art Thou. Definitely. And so it's just a really remarkable thing about this album.
Definitely so. Well, I think we've given the album and the movie its due at this point in time. I think we need to move on to critical reception.
Absolutely. Let's do it.
So there is a Metacritic score for this album. And last week, folks, the album received 83 out of 100. This week, the album received 83 out of 100. It's not a typo. Hey. This also won the Grammy for Album of the Year in 2002. It's 8 times platinum with 9 million copies sold in the U.S. alone. So critically, you know, in the public eye, this was a well-received album. Very, very popular. It was everywhere for mm-hmm. a couple of years at least. What did you see when you were looking for reviews, Chris?
So most of the critical reception of this album is similarly glowing. Jim Caligari of the Austin Chronicle gave it 4 stars. I don't know out of how many, because the article didn't say. I assume out of 5. But, you know, if the guy's a contrarian and he really hated it, it could be 4 out of 10.
His words who knows? Say otherwise, though.
Yeah, absolutely. He says, a celebration of country music's roots that is eclectic and inviting, and one that will resonate for a long time to come. And I don't know for sure. I'm not in Nashville, but I kind of get the sense that this is an evergreen sort of album. Mm-hmm. And part of that might be because the music is so old, but it's also so good. Mm-hmm. You know, it can't be dated because it's that old, and the music, all of the music in it is so powerful. But one of the other reviews, the Pitchfork review I alluded to earlier, Allison Hussey, writing for Pitchfork, gave it an 8.3 out of a 10. And she says, all of a sudden people who thought they didn't like quote unquote folk music, I'm adding air quotes, you can't see because it's a podcast, found themselves enjoying it. The old songs pressed on the reminiscences of some of its audience while acting as a new portal to the past for others, which kind of sums up our experience with it. Definitely. Certainly. But yeah, that's the critically, it was acclaimed by audiences. It was acclaimed. I think that's one of the few instances of that in our podcast so far, because it seems like there are a lot of instances where either the critics pan it and people love it, or, you know, which is rare, the critics loving it and fans kind of really taking a long time to warm up to it. Mm-hmm. But this was definitely a resounding success.
Well, it has a lot to do, too, with just the amazing critical success of this film. I mean, this mm-hmm. movie was still in theaters almost a year after it was released. I mean, it was so popular and was this still drawing volume.
And it was definitely one of those, like, it was just accessible enough as a film that you could bring other people to it. You know, like, you could tell your grandparents, like, hey, I've got this kind of wild and crazy period piece that you should come see.
And other than Babyface Nelson machine gunning a whole bunch of cows, there's really nothing objectionable to the movie on screen.
That was the part of this film that caught me off guard the most.
I hate cows.
If there's any weak part of the film, I do think that maybe Babyface Nelson is it. I can't decide whether I like his part of it or not. It depends on my mood, I think.
I love kind of the crossover and the fun. Like, for a moment there, it's almost like a gangster film and the guys are just along for the ride. And that includes one of my favorite lines from the movie.
Hey, what line of work you in, George?
Just money is flying all over the place and he's shooting machine guns and screaming at the cops.
Come get me, cops. It's so great. One of the things, this has nothing to do with the album, but one of the things about kind of the episodic nature of that movie that I love is even with a crazy character like Babyface Nelson, I'm not sure what they're saying, but, you know, Babyface Nelson has his ups and downs. And so you can tell the Coens are at least like kind of like giving a head nod to people who live for thrills and maybe the kind of person that thrives in the United States. And what does that say about our country at that time? And now, like, it's full of rich little nuggets like that.
Well, and I loved one of the things that kind of caught me off guard on last week's rewatching of it. It had been a couple of years since I watched it, and the scene where Babyface is kind of bearing his soul to the guys out there in the woods and he's really depressed mm-hmm. and down. That scene is a really powerful movie, or a really powerful scene. And shows a lot of just insightful character development from the Coen brothers' point of view. And that scene ends with Ulysses saying something to the effect of, "I believe we haven't seen the last of George Nelson." And that's a great foreshadowing towards the end of the movie when you see George Nelson again, all excited about the electric chair.
Oh, man. So funny. That's stuff that I definitely missed as a kid that as an adult I just cracked up at. It was just so funny to see him like, "Ooh, ride the lightning."
They're going to light me up like a Christmas tree.
Yeah, they're going to light me up like, oh, I forgot about that. That's too good. Well, we have waxed eloquent and ad nauseum. Yeah, eloquent and not so eloquent. What say we give this movie a review?
Absolutely, Chris. To our newest listeners, Chris and I use a 1-6 guitar string review model. And that basically means if it's a 1-string review, it's terrible. And 6 strings, it's phenomenal. We've talked a lot about this album, and I don't think either of us has said anything necessarily bad about it. So, Chris, I'm interested to hear what your thoughts are. The unedited version, please.
All right. Well, it's kind of hard for me to overstate the importance of this album for me personally. And beyond the stuff I mentioned about being opened up to acoustic music and folk music, beyond singing along with this album and learning harmonies, this album just brings me a lot of uncomplicated joy. this is a work of art whose content isn't as emotionally fraught as some of the albums we've gone over in the past. And that's not to say that there isn't a strong emotional through line. You know, these songs, as old as some of them are, we need to remember they were still written by human beings who had their own struggles and triumphs. And I think all of that really comes through. There's a lot of sense memory tied to this album for me. That's another thing. I think of my grandparents' house in Abilene. They sold that house years ago to move to Lubbock and be with my dad and my uncle. And I still think about that place. I associate this movie with that place. I think of my early years learning guitar. I think of the road trip that I mentioned, learning to play Man of Constant Sorrow, which actually me and my friend, our mutual friend, Paul, played during one of our sets at a coffee shop in college. You know, so there's a lot of personal pleasure tied up in this album for me. And I also take another kind of pleasure in this album in that it is uniquely American. This album, this kind of folk music, is a lot like baseball and jazz. It kind of helps me feel some pride in my country at a time in my life where I don't feel that very strongly or very often. It's beautiful folk music that feels genuine and unironic in a time where a lot of art is satirical and biting and vitriolic. You know, and I'm not here to dump on art that has something pointed to say, but sometimes that gets tiring and you just need a break and you need music that is just purely for the enjoyment of it. And that's what this album for me is. I can listen to this album and just unwind and forget things for a bit. I am always riding high like Babyface Nelson when I listen to the soundtrack to Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Although I have avoided machine gunning cows and robbing banks. So I have to give this song 6 out of 6 strings on Tommy Johnson's guitar. Tommy Johnson being the Robert Johnson kind of analog in this movie. But yeah, 6 out of 6 strings, absolutely.
Oh, Chris, this movie and soundtrack are just phenomenal. There isn't a bad casting in the entire thing. From John Goodman to John Turturro to the girls who are singing. I mean, the whole movie is just spot on perfect start to finish. And I love every shot of this movie. I love how mid-century dirty this film looks like. Off mic, you and I talked about how everybody in this movie looks like they're just taken straight from a picture of the 30s. The makeup on this movie, the cinematography, everything about it just screams 1930 depression, just trying to make a living. One thing about this movie that's kind of a plot point to it is they're trying to get to the treasure at their cabin that's in the valley that the Tennessee Valley Authority is getting ready to flood for a hydroelectric dam. And the treasure is supposedly this armored car that he ripped off before going to jail. And then we learn throughout the course of the movie that Ulysses Everett McGill is just a con artist. And he's in jail for being a con artist. He never knocked over an armored car. There is no treasure. It was all just a play to get the guys to break out with him because he wanted to break up a marriage between his wife and her suitor and gets his butt handed to him in 1940s fist fight style, which was one of the funniest scenes in the movie.
Oh, just, man.
Kicked out of the so five and dime and then told he can't come back. And his daughters are telling him he was hit by a train. Like, there are so many things about this movie that just make me excited for the movie itself. And it's 21 years old. I mean, this movie is old enough to drink at this point.
Yes.
And it's still phenomenal. And it's one of those films that has always stuck with me. I remember watching it when I was 12 years old, and this would have been my second exposure loosely to Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, the first being PBS's TV show Wishbone, which had just this absolutely phenomenal Homer's Iliad and Odyssey kind of run through. And then I watched this movie, and then in high school I had to read the book, and the book sucked. And I think it was because it was just a bad translation. Yeah, but I found myself reading the translation of that book through the eyes of Ulysses Everett McGill and the antebellum South and or postbellum South. Thank you. Trying to use big words and using the wrong ones.
That's all right. I'm not going to hold it against you.
I love that it hits all the right notes for me as a movie and as an album. It's thoroughly modern while at the same time being a strictly classical representation of the music that was the Depression era Dust Bowl. People who are down on their luck and just out of it, and there is no relief in sight. I mean, we tend to forget the fact that the Depression in the United States really lasted from 1929 up until the outbreak of World War II in the early 40s when the war economy brought us back. And during that time, these people were living, you know, hand to mouth. And on top of all that, there was a great drought. There was just poor conditions all around. Like, it wasn't like you could just go live off your farm. And you see that in this movie. I mean, even the farmer, the Delmar's cousin, is stuck eating a horse that he had to slaughter last Tuesday because they can't get crops to grow. And it's just one of those movies that I think perfectly captures what historically was the conditions for life in, like, Mississippi in 1930 or 31. There's nothing I don't like about the album. I love the fact that they included recordings from the 30s and 40s. I love the fact that they brought new artists in to record music that was appropriate for the style of the film. I love that they were so committed to effects that made it sound like it was recorded on much older equipment than it was. And in a lot of cases, that comes across as kitschy and fake and, you know, just trying too hard. This movie doesn't. This album doesn't. This album sounds genuine and real to the time that it's portraying in a way that really very few are capable of doing. And I think that speaks to both the genius of the Coen brothers as creative forces and of their willing to let creative people make something special, because they're not musicians. They know enough to let go of the reins and let something happen. And you see that in a lot of their films. Listening to this album really brought back just tons of fond memories for me with my brothers, you know, skipping through theaters and, you know, sneaking around and keeping that Dr. Pepper cup full and just enjoying time with each other and watching this movie over and over again. I can't say enough good things about this. It's been saved on my phone for years. It hasn't been off of my phone in years. It's not one of those ones that I let fall off. And it's 6 out of 6 strings. No matter how I cut it, I can't take a string away from anything, even if there are some moments in the movie that make me cringe.
If you're not a fan of cow murder, that this film might not be for you.
Cow murder, cross burnings for effect. I mean, there are some scenes that are like, oh, that just does not sit well. But it tells the story, and I think it tells the story as accurately as you're going to see out of a mass-produced Hollywood picture.
Yeah.
So I've given my album my album. Well, look at what I did, Chris.
I mean, honestly, this album is only on my list because it wasn't already on yours, and the other way around. Like, I think it probably would have wound up on your list if I hadn't already. This was one of the first albums, honestly, that we mentioned. I think when we were talking about doing this, this was album number one that I was like, oh, we have to talk about O Brother, Where Art Thou?
This is one of the albums that we used to establish ground rules about what counts as an album, because you reached out to me and were like, would you count the soundtrack from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou as an album. And my immediate response, like seconds later, was heck yes.
Yeah, like so. Unconditionally. Absolutely.
So I'm glad we got to do it. I really appreciate the conversation. Let's talk a little bit about our favorite and our least favorite tracks. What was your favorite track, Chris?
All right. So my favorite track was a tough one. When I was a kid, I used to know all the words to Big Rock Candy Mountain. I also made it a point to try and memorize In the Jailhouse Now. But I think my favorite track has to be Angel Band. It's the song at the very end of the film. The lyrics to this old hymn were written in 1860, by Jefferson Haskell. The music is by J.W. Dadman. And it reminds me of every time I've sat in church singing hymns. Just one of the pure experiences that I personally have had in church. And I always sing along with pretty much this entire album with a few exceptions, but especially this tune. I always sing along with Angel Band. It is my favorite track on this album. What about you? What's your favorite track?
My favorite track, hands down, and it's not even close. It sticks with me. It's one of those tracks that has been in my mind since the first time I ever saw this movie, is Oh Death. I use the term haunting so often when I talk about favorite songs, and it's such a cheap get out, but it's a song that makes me really stop and think about what the future holds for me and the fact that the one thing that we're not going to escape no matter what we do is death. And this song, even though it's about death, is about the hope that of what we will do in between the time. You know, death don't come for me. I'm not done yet. Mm-hmm. And it's contemplative, and it's something that even years between viewing this movie, years between listening to it, it's one of those songs that just inspires me to think about what am I doing with the time I have left. And I'm afraid that the older I get, the more time I will spend wondering that and trying to economize on what I'm doing, because I find myself doing it more than I did when I was 12 and more than when I was 20. And it's like, oh shoot, like, let's be careful here. But Ralph Stanley recorded this back in the day. I'm not exactly sure when he recorded this, but this was not recorded for the movie. It's an old recording. Mm-hmm. And he won a Grammy in 2002 for Best Country Song for this song all these years after he'd recorded it. And he deserved two if they could have found two to give him. It's just so powerful.
Yeah, it really is like one of the most powerful. I think a lot of the most powerful stuff in this album is the stuff that is solely human voices. Mm-hmm. I think like Poe Lazarus at the beginning of the film, mm-hmm, is just dudes working, guys basically in state sponsored slavery, working a chain gang. I think the track is called Lonesome Valley.
Yep.
In the scene where they're about to be hung when they're at the cabin. That stuff is all the most powerful, and it's just voices.
What I had forgotten about, and one thing that may be a strike against this this pick for best song, is Oh Death is the song that the man sings during the lynching scene of the Ku Klux Klan that is foiled by the guys when they save their guitarist, who supposedly sold his soul to the devil so he could play that guitar. And I had forgotten that, so I had picked this as my favorite, and then rewatched it and was like, that's a scene.
yeah. I think as far as using that in a comedy film, it didn't stick out to me as distasteful, because the Coens are definitely taking the idiocy of racism to task. It's kind of, there's a kind of similar song in Django similar scene in Django Unchained where the KKK guys are all standing around arguing about the hoods. Yep. And you know, like,
these were a great idea, but next time we'll get the holes even.
Exactly. And and so Mary Margaret. I don't find the Klan stuff in that movie particularly offensive. Also because John Goodman's character gets
obliterated
and by a flaming cross that falls over on him.
This movie was probably the first time that I really wished death upon a character in a movie. And after he crushed Pete the Frog, and that scene is like heartbreaking. Just
it is
because he's such of a Delmar's jerk. Delivery of it is just so good. And yeah, so when he gets his comeuppance by a burning cross, just taking him out.
Oh man, it's fantastic.
Or the implied comeuppance, let's say that.
Yeah, yeah. The camera cuts away, but we all know that he got squished like a frog. So those are our favorite tracks. What is your least favorite track?
Least favorite track for me. This one was kind of a struggle. We say that often, which especially on a 6-for-6 string album, that's going to be hard. For me, the track that I really forgot was even a part of this album, like it did not stick with me, and I think it's kind of just a lazy track in general, is Indian War Whoop. It's a fiddle track that's imitating a train moving along the tracks, and there's just this kind of lamentation style war whoop that's more of like the dying cry of the Indian race. And that's probably what the Coen brothers are trying to allude to, that, you know, they've been so far marginalized that that's all that's left to have a war whoop.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't really fit into the film where it is in the film, and it's not a good fit where it is in the album, in the soundtrack, and it's just kind of lazy feeling. It doesn't work for me. So that's the one I just cut.
That song, I never like listening to it in the album, but I do. I think it has, I mean, what you're talking about as far as the content of the song, you have this clash of like a fiddle, and you know, the fiddle's imitating a train whistle, and you have the kind of competing sort of Native American approximation of a melody there. If you're looking at that album through the lens of like the modern era of, you know, railroads and technology coming through and destroying the indigenous way of life, I think there might, and I don't know, this could be like a lot of an overreach of logic, but the scene that that song plays over in the film is when Babyface Nelson is being hauled off to be, you know, lit up like a Christmas tree. And so I think for me anyway, contextually, there's kind of an interesting parallel between somebody like Babyface Nelson, who could not hack living in a world that demanded law and order from him, and kind of the parallels between the way that song is. So I think for me personally, I don't like listening to the song. It isn't doing anything for me on a musical level, but I think at least within the film, it's kind of interesting. Like, but all that to say, I definitely see why that's your least favorite track. As far as the music that's on this album goes, it has stiff competition, and there's just not that much going for it.
And in the context of the film itself, it's played so low compared to Babyface Nelson talking about how great his glorious death is going to be, that you almost even miss that it's even there entirely.
So
it's almost like it's just background noise to fill in the fact that they didn't have a Foley track to go with the crowd.
Yeah, well, and they had a guy, an extra in the crowd with a fiddle, and so they probably were like, oh, shoot, this will be perfect. Yeah. We'll just throw this one in there.
What was your least favorite?
So my least favorite is actually probably one of the better executed tracks as far as vocals and harmonies go on the album is Didn't Leave Nobody But the Baby. It's not that I think this tune is bad or misplaced. It's great in the film because you're sitting there with Pete's weird relatives all just sitting around and the song is kind of playing. I think it's playing over an old radio.
Yeah, a phonograph.
When they're sitting around there.
It's not even on
there.
A radio.
Oh, is it really? It's a very eerie tune. And I love eerie, weird films and eerie weird music.
For those of you wondering, that's episode 14, episode 16, episode 17.
Oh man, not that you're keeping count or anything.
Not at all, no.
But I remember being really creeped out by the song as a kid. Like I would skip it because it was just so like, oh, I don't want to listen to that. Like just freaky.
That is such a creepy scene. Like for the first time watching that movie, I remember thinking somebody's going to die in this scene. Like something just creepy is going to happen here.
There's a weird sense of menace in that scene that kind of seems a little, it would seem out of place, except for the whole movie is kind of bananas. So it doesn't, it's not really out of place, but it is, you almost want the Coens to direct a horror film just for how strange that part of the movie is.
No, because I would spend the whole time laughing. Like,
yeah, you would just be thinking of Pete and Delmer and Ulysses.
Where's my hairnet? How's my hair?
All right. Well, we have exhausted everything from this soundtrack and this movie, I think. Why don't we hit up the Oracle for a cookie and our next album?
Number 29 from my list, Chris. This is Andrew Peterson's Counting Stars. Came out in 2010. And it's our first strictly Christian album, which will be an interesting conversation. I don't know how familiar you are with Andrew Peterson, but this is an album that definitely holds a very special place in my heart from a very tough time in my life. So I'm excited to share it with you this week.
Yeah, I'm excited to hear it. He's that's not a name that I recognize, so it'll be interesting. Can you believe that 2010 was 11 years ago?
We're so old. I say that every week.
I know. This is really the mortality podcast. Two dudes and their own mortality.
Dude, 2010 is when I started to legally drink.
Man.
Things have gone downhill since then, but here we are.
Yeah, we did an album that is old enough to drink on this album, and it's something that came out of my childhood. It's getting real. All right, well, folks, look, if you had fun, if you enjoyed this, please rate and review it on iTunes. That helps whatever magical voodoo algorithms that Apple Podcasts operates on kind of push us towards other people. And also there's always the chance that we might read your reviews on air. So thank you for listening. Please leave us a comment and a review. We'd very much appreciate it.
What? Yes. And if you want to get in touch with us, shoot us an email at twodudesandtunes@gmail.com. We love hearing what you have to say, any input. Chris and I are by no means the fact masters, and sometimes we get things wrong. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram or Facebook. We're at Two Dudes and Tunes on both of those platforms. Tell us what you thought about Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And don't forget to tune in next week when we dive deep into the no-holds-barred cage match that is my relationship with the church and Christianity, when we listen to Andrew Peterson's musings on the same. We'll see you next time.